climate change, the topic we were into an hour ago or so, talking about the presentation by the U.S. at the U.N. climate conference that ended up generating quite a protest, conversation about the value of coal in front of a group of climate change people. Didn't go over too well yesterday. But the bigger story last Friday, was it last Friday? Or no, it was Black Friday, actually, I guess, that the climate assessment report came out. A lot of people thought that was a news dump on a Friday, so attention wouldn't be paid to it. But you can't get away with it that easily. A lot of people are focused on it. A person who we're going to speak with here next on the show, writing for New Food Economy, has some thoughts on our takeaways from that climate assessment. And it's Claire Brown who's joining me now via telephone. Claire, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, we're excited too. Let's get right into it. Around these parts in grape-growing country, people are talking about the impact on the local agriculture, what it will mean for future wine grape growing. That's just one really small part of this picture. A lot of what you've been writing about addresses agriculture in a broader sense. Let's start there. What's the once over lightly on that whole aspect of it?
So the big picture we're getting out of this climate change report is that everything is shifting. Droughts are getting longer and California fires are getting worse. Allergy season is getting longer, and the water table is just going down and down in many places. And so what we're seeing is a little bit of a patchwork of effects. So, for instance, in the Midwest and corn country, the growing season is actually longer. So we're getting more productive corn fields right now. But the report shows that that's not going to last. That's kind of a temporary boom. And we're going to start to see that decline. Meanwhile, up in Canada, where they've never been able to grow corn before, farmers are cutting down forests to grow cornfields. And so, as you can see, everything's kind of shifting north and shifting west. And this report kind of chronicles, kind of paints a picture of what that looks like.
Yeah, and as I understand it from my limited ability to consume all the information, the effects in terms of temperatures are seemingly more extreme the further away from the equator you go. Is that accurate?
I believe that is accurate. And again, it's not that everything's universally getting hotter. In the Northeast, for instance, one thing that's affected climate change, an impact of climate change here is that we're actually getting later snows. So farmers are having to plan around, you know, the last 3 years, I think we've had an April or late March snowstorm, which obviously will kill a crop that's been put in the ground before that. And so you're right. The more extreme temperatures are something that, according to this report, we're already seeing, and it's only going to get worse.
Yeah. This acceleration has been pretty disturbing. There wasn't that long ago. Climate assessments were saying, well, you know, in 20 years or in 50 years, and now it seems like that time frame is getting compacted. We're starting to see changes that were predicted to be significantly in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. And not this report, but about a month or two ago, there was another report that came out that said, you know, we've all been sort of looking at this 2-3 degrees Celsius range that'll really have these catastrophic effects. But this report was saying we'll start to see these very significant changes at 1.5 degrees, which means we have until about 2030 to turn it all around.
Whew, that's coming up pretty quick.
Yeah.
2030. The older you get, the more that time goes racing by. It'll be 2030 in a blink. So when we talk about something that increases the temperatures in some places, not everywhere, but in some places, starts to get hotter. It's not just that your grapes are going to ripen faster or that your corn crop will come in, you know, bigger or sooner or something because of nice, robust sunshine, but you start to see these other impacts like you write about on things like pollen and the pests in the fields and so on. Talk about that aspect a little bit. There's a lot about pollen in your story.
Yeah, so there are all these little things that you kind of wouldn't think of immediately. You know, we think of droughts, we think of heat waves. But what's happening is as the growing season lengthens, the pollen-producing plants are starting to produce pollen for a little bit longer. Meanwhile, the life cycles of the bees hasn't changed in sync with that, and so we're having this sort of divergence of you know, the bees' life cycles and the pollen's life cycle, and allergens like ragweed, which thrive in conditions that are, you know, inhospitable to other plants, those are doing great. Additionally, you know, pests that we worry about, like mosquitoes, like ticks that carry Lyme disease, those are all things that places like the Northeast don't have to worry about so much because we have this deep freeze every summer, every winter, and we're having less and less of that. So I think about a year ago I wrote about these really nasty green crabs that are an invasive species from Europe, and the cold freezes over the winter has kind of kept them in check. But in the last few years, they haven't all been dying out every winter, and so their populations are just proliferating. And I got to go out in a boat with a guy who lives in a marsh up in Massachusetts, and there's just kind of layers of these crabs on the bottom of the marsh floor, and it's very striking to see. So pests and weeds are kind of thriving in these new conditions.
Which may lead some people then to what? New efforts to eradicate pests using what? Chemicals? And then are we, you know, creating a new problem?
Yeah, we are. It's particularly difficult for farmers who are trying to use organic methods, who are trying to do integrated pest management. In many cases, all of a sudden, you'll see a pest that you've absolutely never seen before, and it'll kind of come at you in the middle of the growing season. So, you know, farmers often have the winter to prepare for what's coming up. But if there's a brand new pest that you've never had to deal with before, that's going to throw a wrench in your system. I visited a farm a couple months ago that had a blight on their, I believe it was a raspberry crop that they'd never seen before, and it happened in the middle of the season, and they didn't want to use pesticides, but they didn't want it to spread, so they ended up just cutting out about half of their blackberry trees.
So a changing picture season to season now for a lot of people in agriculture is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it doesn't just affect plants. I was surprised in this report that there was discussion also of its impact on the dairy industry. You don't think about it, but cows actually produce less milk in instances of extreme heat because they have less appetite and their metabolism slows down. You know, it's like us. We're not as hungry when it's really, really hot outside. And so already by 2010, the dairy industry was losing an estimated $1.2 billion to something called heat stress, which is, you know, when the cows produce less milk because they're too hot. Mm-hmm. And so the financial damages that heat stress is going to bring on the dairy industry is expected to hit around 1% of their total productivity. So there are all these little impacts that we wouldn't really think about that are outlined in this report.
We're talking here with Claire Brown from the New Food Economy, which is newfoodeconomy.org. She is writing on food policy and the environment. And we're talking about the climate assessment report that came out recently and others that are providing us information about this ongoing change that's happening in front of us and the ramifications turning out to be a lot broader than just the idea that, yes, the hurricanes are bigger, yes, we've had worse wildfires, but all of these smaller but interconnected, and when they're all added together, bigger impacts. One of the, to me, in my mind, both optimistic ways of looking at things and dangerous ways of looking at things is to say there will be an answer. Science will have an answer. We have overcome a lot of diseases in the human species. We've overcome diseases in plant species. Will there be some kind of ag industry response that will solve these problems? Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so first of all, I should say that, you know, the ag industry is very involved in the climate change discussion, but it's still the energy sectors that are contributing to 70% of climate change. And so that kind of has to get figured out separately. That said, ag has a potentially huge part to play in driving solutions. So, you know, cover crops can be great for carbon sequestration if they are grown on fallow land. You know, if we put more acreage that's resting into conservation, that can actually suck carbon out of the air and be a net positive for farming. There are lots of promising technologies in terms of alternative fuels that can come from farms. So, as you know, we now have ethanol, which involves growing new corn acreage to produce gas for our cars. But scientists are looking at finding ways of producing gas that is actually from byproducts of the agriculture industry. So some folks think, you know, you don't need the corn kernels, but you can take the husk and the stalk of the corn plant after that corn has already been harvested for consumption by humans or animals and turn that into gasoline. And so there's a lot of excitement around the potential, A, for farms to aid in carbon sequestration by devoting more acreage to conservation, and B, for the potential of farms to actually be producing fuel to power our cars.
Well, that's certainly, that's a little bit of a bright, shining silver lining, maybe, huh? A little bit?
Absolutely. Yeah, we have a very long way to go before we're using sugarcane and leftover corn to power our vehicles. But, you know, in California, there's a Toyota plant that's using emissions from cows to power a new fleet of cars. They're converting the cow, essentially, excrement into hydrogen fuel. And they're going to open a factory that runs only on hydrogen fuel in the next couple of years. And so there's lots of interesting things happening, particularly in California, with the intersection of agriculture and energy production.
Unfortunately, it sometimes seems like California is trying to lead, but there's a lot of resistance in other parts of the country. And of course, we know there's a lot of resistance in the current political climate from the administration. Do we see that, is there any potential for change of attitude, in the near term from people who are in charge right now? We have, it seems to be a lot of, you know, towing the line to do what the president thinks or, you know, follow that line of thinking. And it's infiltrated agencies like the EPA and, you know, USDA and others that are key in this situation.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this administration kind of tipped its hat when President Trump publicly said that he didn't believe what was in this report. I think there's not much of a chance that this presidential administration will change its tune on climate change adaptation. But, you know, new Democrats in the House are pushing something called a Green New Deal, which, if implemented, would really, really push to get us off of coal. You know, I think there's, with the sort of trio or set of four really gigantic recent climate stories, it seems like the issue is worming its way into the public discussion. I've been noticing that people at the checkout counter are talking about it now in a way that perhaps they weren't 4 or 5 years ago. So I think the political will to make this change is starting to build again. I don't have super high hopes for this presidential administration, but maybe we'll start to see states adopting progressive climate policies. I know New York City, where I am, is looking at how to reduce emissions from, you know, building cooling systems. And so I think on the local and state levels, there's definitely energy going in that direction.
Yeah. There's a big land use component in this, too. And you note in your piece that here in California, for example, where farmland or forest land or other kinds of non-developed environments become developed, that's having an impact as well in a variety of ways. Speak to that a little?
Yeah. So part of this report indicated that the amount of land developed for urban use, that's essentially, you know, turning stuff into concrete, will increase by 50%, and the land developed for suburbs will increase 80% by 2050, which is between 520 and 600,000 square miles of land that's either currently being used for agriculture or it's just undeveloped. It's a forest, it's a park, it's undeveloped land. And so that's obviously not caused by climate change. That's caused by population growth and cities that need more and more space. But the impact it has is that you're replacing all of that green carbon sequestering vegetation with concrete that doesn't do a whole lot to take carbon out of the air and can actually reflect the light and make cities hotter. And so essentially, if you're just getting rid of green land cover, you're going to start exacerbating the problems of climate change. And we're looking at a lot of that happening by 2050, and that's kind of an often overlooked part of this debate.
Yeah, and if you look at the trend, it's still, you know, what started in the early 1900s is still continuing in the sense that people are still moving into cities. Leaving rural communities, leaving the countryside, leaving the farms, and coming into the cities. So the cities are continuing to get larger and consume more of everything and create more damage. This whole thing about treading lightly on the land, which when you live out in a sparsely populated area, it's kind of possible to do. But most of us who live in urban environments, you can't really tread that lightly.
And as those urban environments grow, they also place greater demands on the natural resources, which is a little bit about what you were getting at.
Yeah.
But in California, demand for water in these developed areas is going to increase by 60% by 2100. And so, you know, from a very raw resource perspective, that's less water for agriculture. And as we know, California already has water problems. And so, you know, it's a cascading effect that's sort of similar to what we talked about with agriculture.
Yeah, and far-flung development of different resources to provide energy, water, and other things to cities, that, you know, is an impact when we're in the city. We don't see what's happening out in the peripheral canal or the, you know, whatever's going on to subsidize urban living, as it were.
Absolutely.
Well, this has been a very cheerful enjoyable spell. Claire Brown, writing for New Food Economy on some of the takeaways from the recent climate assessment report. And it is a look at agriculture very specifically. And I think, you know, above all, if you can't connect with all of that talk, this whole thing about the allergy season being longer is enough reason for a lot of people around here to care.
Mm-hmm. Right? Absolutely.
Please. Only the makers of antihistamines are excited about that. Claire, thanks for your time today. Great content. Hope we can talk again.
Thanks so much for having me, right. And I hope we talk again soon.
You bet. Have a good day. Okay. It's 7:54 now at KVON. Time for a break. More of our morning show on the way.